Thursday,
calling
October
for a rapid and radical return to
show.
The old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program. It is Friday. It's the last day of the week. It's the day when the first hour of our program is always devoted to Brunch with Bernie, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's line about White House briefings. CNN records the latest spin from Karl Rove's attorney, Mr. Robert Luskin. He told everyone who asked him, this Luskin says, he told everyone who asked him, including the federal prosecutor, that he's not part of any scheme. He said that's the allegation the president and White House press secretary Scotty McClellan were commenting on when they received assurances from Karl Rove that he had done nothing wrong. According to the transcripts, that's simply not true. McClellan was not assured by Rove that he was not part of any scheme. McClellan was categorically assured by Rove that he wasn't involved, period. From the 9/29/03 briefing, this is from the thinkprogress.org blog. All right, question. All right, let me just follow up. You said this morning, the president knows that Karl Rove wasn't involved. How does he know that? McClellan. Well, I've made it very clear that it was a ridiculous suggestion in the first place. I saw some comments this morning from the person who made that suggestion backing away from that, and I said it's simply not true. So, I mean, it's public knowledge. I've said that it's not true, and I've spoken with Karl Rove. There's more of the same at this morning's press gaggle. As Stephen Colbert notes, mainstream sources like CNN appear unwilling to fact-check statements from people like Luskin because there's a fear of appearing too aggressive. A fear of appearing too aggressive. They're unwilling to fact-check the news. They're told something by Rove's lawyer. They're told something by Bush's lawyer. They're told something by official spokespeople from the RNC, and they're unwilling to fact-check it because they don't want to seem too aggressive. What's wrong with this picture? So, it's up to... This is Stephen Colbert of The Daily Show laying out what's going on inside the Bush administration. CNN won't talk about it. I mean, this is like, you know, truly bizarre and truly scary when you get right down to it. I mean, when you consider how could this be? How could this be? Here's another one this morning. MSNBC, or NBC, the big network, not MSNBC, but NBC, you know, one of the big three. On the Today Show, Matt Lauer interviewing the president. The president lies. Does Lauer say, excuse me, Mr. President? Now, you wouldn't expect him to say, ha ha, liar, liar, pants on fire. You wouldn't expect something like that. But at the very least, I mean, in the old days, you know, when Cronkite would interview Nixon or something like, and somebody would come out with some just bald-faced lie, you would, at the very least, you would hear a reporter, a real live reporter say, well, sir, that seems to contradict what you said earlier. Or, sir, that... seems to be a little inconsistent with what is known. Or, I mean, you know, there's a lot of polite ways of saying to a politician, you know, we think you're lying to us. But Matt Lauer did none of them. Matt Lauer says, does it worry you that the prosecutors seem to have such an interest in Mr. Rove? Bush. This morning on NBC, I'm not going to talk about the case. I've been asked this a lot, and my answer is consistent. Well, in fact, his answer is not consistent. His answer's been all over the map. First, when he was asked to comment on the leak investigation, he said he wanted to know the details. I want to get to the bottom of this. In fact, on 9:30, he said, listen, I know of nobody. I don't know of anybody in my administration who leaked classified information. If somebody did leak classified information, I'd like to know it, and we'll take the appropriate action. Then he decided, yeah, it's pretty unlikely we'll find out who leaked the information. You know, it's just one of those things that, you know, as Don Rumsfeld likes to talk about, the unknown unknowns. You know, there are knowns that can be known, and there are unknowns that can be unknown, and one of the unknown unknowns is...
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, he just doesn't know. So you've got the unknown unknowns as well. And, you know, so on it goes. And then you go back to George W. Bush, and then he says, this was back on June of this year. That was a year ago. Now this year, in June of this year, do you stand by your pledge to fire anyone found to have leaked the name of a CIA agent? Bush, yes. So, hasn't been exactly consistent in terms of, you know, speaking out on these things. In fact, not at all. Goes on to say, I would like this leak investigation to end as quickly as possible so we know the facts. If somebody committed a crime, they will no longer work in my administration, says George W. Bush. So, I mean, you know, go figure. But the bottom line, and thanks to FaZe for posting this over on the blog there at thinkprogress.org. So the bottom line, who knows? We don't know. They don't know. Nobody knows. It's unknowable. As Donnie Rumsfeld would say, it's one of those known unknowns. It's one of those known knowns. It's one of those unknown unknowns. It's, you know, sometimes you don't know anything, you know, it's just...
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
Yeah, and there you go. I mean, that's clearly we're talking about the unknown unknowns. Is this all starting to make sense to you? It's just, it's the tragedy of the media. The tragedy of the Bush administration, the tragedy of an administration that's willing to say, that is willing to just come right out and essentially say to people that if you're going to pursue us, if you're going to ask hard questions, if you're going to be, you know, laying anything out at all, then we're going to nail you on it. And it's just so wrong to be using that power, the power of access, to say, no, we will not be held accountable. In the meantime, the confirmation debate with Harriet Myers is going on. This in reverse. I played yesterday for you a couple of times the clip of the super-duper double-entry, top-secret, buried deeper than you could ever imagine, you know, whatever, phone conference, the teleconference that was held, where Mr. Land on the teleconference was going on and saying, well, you know, Harriet Myers, it's Richard Land. She's not going to vote against the Bush administration because that would be perceived as a betrayal, you know.
We both understand that if she were to get on the court and she were to rule in ways that are contrary to the way the president would want her to approach her role as a justice, it would be a deep personal betrayal and would be perceived as such both by him and by her.
And there you go. She's not going to betray her man. She's not going to betray George. And so I find this really quite interesting. You've got a lot of Democrats who are standing back going, well, maybe they're going to self-destruct. Maybe they're going to melt down. Maybe the GOP, you know. But I have to say, if Harriet Myers gets put on the bench, the downside for those interested in democracy, the downside is that if any of Bush's crimes, any of Bush's cronies, any of the criminal stuff associated with the Bush administration, going all the way back to his father in the October surprise, as Robert Perry just wrote about, if any of that stuff comes before the Supreme Court, they've got a friend in Harriet, and they know it. And, you know, in fact, some suggesting that that's why they've got her on. On the other hand, when it comes to the issues of our day, and there are many, she may be a little more reasonable. I mean, and this is why the conservatives are all hysterical, that she might be the Harriet Meyer, she might be a decent justice. It's 9:16. I'm Tom Hartman.
Exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled.
In reverse, we were talking about this. Harriet Myers, religion in the court. Yep, the op-ed on today's Wall Street Journal. What matters aren't Ms. Myers' personal views on abortion or what church she attends, says the Wall Street Journal. What matters is what she thinks about the judiciary and specifically whether she believes it has the limited constitutional role that the founders intended. Now, does Harriet Myers believe that we should have slavery? Does Harriet Myers believe that women should not be voting? Well, anyhow, the Wall Street Journal continues to say the White House could help its credibility if it focused on that question and stopped touting her irrelevant religious beliefs. Well, you know, what clearly the Wall Street Journal is missing is that, you know, there's a battle going on for the base over here in the Republican Party. And it's just they're having a terrible time with, you know, how do they get this stuff out? How do they make it clear? How are they going to get the information out? And then in the meantime, you've got, you know, they're trying to prepare the base for the criminal indictments. Bill Kristol on Fox News Sunday, criminal defense lawyers. He says, this is from Bill Kristol on Fox News Sunday. Criminal defense lawyers I've spoken with are friendly to the administration, worried that one or more indictments in the next 3 weeks are coming down the road. We mentioned this yesterday. It's preparing the base. Tom DeLay going down. Bill Frist being investigated for insider trading. I mean, it's just one thing after another, and it's really starting to batter the Republicans. The culture of corruption that they are being referred to as is really starting to batter the Republicans. Did the Bush administration trump up the subway threat? You know, a good question. Again, we discussed this yesterday. The Bush administration still relying on torture. Bush says he's going to veto an anti-torture law after a Senate revolt. This is from the Telegraph. The Bush administration pledged to veto legislation banning the torture of prisoners by U.S. troops after an overwhelming and almost unprecedented revolt by loyalist congressmen. This is going to be incredible. You know, if George Bush comes out and says, okay, the official position of this government is not, it's not even really in favor of or against torture. And that's the thing that so many people don't get, that they're just completely missing. It's not about pro or con torture. What it's about, tragically, what it's about is the manual, the Army manual. Will we follow the rules that we have, the basic rules that are right there in the Army manual? It's not like the government is suddenly deciding we're going to allow torture or we're not going to allow torture. We have never allowed torture in the United States, and since World War II, it's been in the Army manual. It's been of all of the armed forces. It's right there. When you go through boot camp and you get a short course in the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and you learn what the rules of war are because you're being trained to participate in that theater, in that world. The world of warfare. You're being trained to kill people and blow things up. It's why we have militaries. And, you know, and thank God. I mean, you know, we defeated Hitler that way. And there are certain rules to war that we've all agreed on. And the goal of these rules of war is twofold. Number one, to actually try to minimize the casualties of war on both sides so that the goals of war, that is, you know, to stop tyrants, to, you know, to do good things, can be accomplished with the minimum amount of human death and suffering. And number two, and perhaps most importantly, actually, number two, so that civilians aren't caught in the crossfire. And what we're seeing now is that in the wars of 50 and 100 years ago, World War I, back into the Civil War, that civilians were, by and large, you know, there were a lot of civilian deaths, but most of the deaths were combatants. Nowadays, because so much of our war is happening high-tech, it's bombers, it's missiles, it's all these kinds of things, so many of our wars instead of being conducted hand-to-hand combat, we're seeing enormous civilian casualties. It's how the British journal The Lancet came up with this figure of 100,000 Iraqis dead. It's 2 million Vietnamese dead in the war there. What did we do? We carpet-bombed entire areas. But beyond that, well, and you go back to World War II, also the bombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, enormous civilian deaths. And so the rules of war, and in Vietnam, you know, where we used defoliant, we spread Agent Orange all over the place to try and make it impossible for people to live and make it impossible for people to grow things. And so what you find is that the whole point of the rules of war are to protect the warriors in a way and to protect the civilians in a way. And just straightforward stuff. And it's right there in the Army manual. And all this law that John McCain attached to this bill would do is say our soldiers have to pay attention to what it says in the Army manual. They simply have to follow the rules in the Army manual. I mean, that's it. That's all they're saying. It's follow the rules in the Army manual. And Bush says, no, we're going to veto this because we're not going to follow the rules in the Army manual. Can you believe that? We're not going to follow the rules. And Bush is going to veto to say, we're not even going to follow the rules that the United States put in place? It's wrong, my friends. It's just absolutely wrong. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
First we'll frisk you, then we'll test you, and it won't be so bad if you should fail. Tell my friends I, if they arrest you, 'cause they've also spent time in jail. You will arrest you, a nation's checkered, but we'll keep you in the line all day and night, because we'll have a perfect record as long as no one
makes their flight. Drop those tweezers and ditch those nail clips, because you know that they could form a threat to life. You can take them on your air trips, but you still can pack a knife.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, along with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, the last day of every week, our Brunch with Bernie segment. For more information about what Bernie Sanders is up to, about his campaign, about the information. And, I got to say, it's so weird. It almost sounds like conspiracy theory. It is so weird that, but you say it, you know, it's like, it is so weird to say the only two people in the United States Senate who had the power to stop the Patriot Act. They were Pat Leahy, who was the, keep in mind, just months before this, the Republicans controlled the Senate when Bush came into power by one vote. And Jim Jeffords, the Republican from Vermont, said, that's it, this party has turned so far to the right, it doesn't resemble anything I know from America anymore. I am going away from the Republican Party, and from now on, the Republican Party is going to be, you know, without me. And that caused the Republicans to lose control of the Senate. So now the Judiciary Committee, out of which the legislation for the Patriot Act would have to pass, the Judiciary Committee is now being controlled by Pat Leahy. Pat Leahy is the Democrat from Vermont, was the number one, and he could have killed the bill. He could have simply said, okay, you know, that's it. We're not going to let it out of committee. We're not going to schedule a vote on it. We're not, I mean, he's a committee chairman, kill bills all the time, routinely. Particularly Republican committee chairman, you know, a bill to bring to the floor a vote on the impeachment of George W. Bush, a bill to bring to the floor a vote on rolling back Bush's tax cuts. I mean, there's been no shortage of things that have been killed in committee. So Pat Leahy had the ability to kill the Patriot Act in committee and seemed inclined to do so. And Tom Daschle, who as the Senate majority leader, the head Democrat in the Senate, the guy who determines the schedule for the entire Senate and what gets voted on and when it gets voted on, he had the ability to kill the Patriot Act. They were the only two guys. In the Patriot Act, this multi-hundred-page document, 300-400-page document that comes just magically, I mean, just appears. The Bush administration comes in, oh, 9/11, whoop. You know, we got to do something about it. Oh, by the way, here's the Patriot Act. Where'd that come from? Oh, it's just been kind of sitting around for a while. Very carefully thought through. This thing had been in the works for years. But Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle didn't know it. The Democrats didn't know it. And I suspect a lot of the Republicans didn't know it. So the Bush administration whips out the Patriot Act and they say, here you go, guys, vote on it. And Leahy says, you know, I want to learn a little more about this. And Daschle says, I want to learn a little more about this. And they bring in their staffs, and they get all kinds of evidence and all kinds of information, and they got it all piled up all around their office. And then Pat Leahy's office and Tom Daschle's office happen to be the only two places in all of Washington, D.C. that receive anthrax in the mail. And suddenly they have to leave their offices, they have to leave behind all the paperwork, they have to leave behind all the evidence, all the information, and go basically, you know, have a temporary office someplace else. And they don't have information. They don't have access to all this information that they had. And America is like in terror. And who is trying to kill us? The only two people that the anthrax killer target, the anthrax killer who, by the way, I'm not sure we're still even looking for. The anthrax killer went after only two people, politicians. I mean, you know, there was the gratuitous, oh, let's go after a couple of journalists and make it look good. That'll certainly whip people up. That'll scare a lot of people. You want to get something in the press, go after the press, right? So they did that, and Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy, the only two members of Congress who got anthrax. So anyhow, we had the anthrax attacks. Well, let's use that to set aside civil liberties in America. After all, we don't need those pesky civil liberties. We had 9/11. Let's use that to set aside civil liberties in America. All through the election period of 2004, we got to have the president. You know, he's a high-profile target. We got to have free speech zones. These grandmothers with their raging granny signs. These women from Code Pink. You never know. One of them might be like Squeaky Fromm. Might have an idea to kill a president. We got to send them off into the free speech zone, a half a mile away from where George Bush is speaking. Put them behind some barbed wire. Put a couple cops with guns in front of them. Let them talk all they want, as loud as they want, where no one can hear them, where no one can see them. Keep them out of the view of the TV cameras. Strange things happening in this country, my friends. And now George W. Bush comes out and he says, okay, bird flu, yeah, we got a problem. We've got, you know, we've got this virus. And it appears to be mutating. And if it mutates in such a way that it can occupy the body of human beings, then we have a serious problem. A very serious problem. That problem being that you got a pandemic. Millions of people around the world will die from this virus. And so let's use that. I mean, this is even scarier than the anthrax attack, right? This is even scarier than 3,000 people dead at 9/11. We're talking about millions of people dead. That's a good excuse to suspend civil liberties. That's a good excuse to say we should bring the army into our cities. The army who is trained in how to blow things up and how to kill people, as opposed to the civil authorities that are under the that are in the community, that are based in the community, that live in the community, that are responsive to the community, that are under the supervision of the mayors and the county commissioners and the governors. No, no, forget them. We're going to bring in the federal army. Shades of Shays Rebellion. I mean, even back then, they were using the local militias. This from Online Journal, Larry Chin, the associate editor. Now, keep in mind, this was a week ago that this first came out, but there's been not only no backing away from it, but now the media chorus is actually starting to trumpet this. They're starting to say, yeah, this might be a good idea. George W. Bush and his administration announced that they intend to dispatch federal troops to enforce quarantines in the event of a bird flu outbreak. This followed a closed-door session in which the U.S. Congress was propagandized about a bird flu pandemic scenario by the Bush administration's Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt. To quote Harry Reid, the session scared the hell out of me. Yeah, well, I'm sure that anthrax did too. They're calling for a flu pandemic coordinator. Where? Within the White House, of course. More power to the president. The presidency in the United States is increasingly starting to look, you know, horribly and increasingly starting to look like some sort of kingdom. Like some sort of kingship. It's like we're back to, you know, France in the 18th century. Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette. Oh, let's just have another party. Black boots and caviar. And the people of the United States of America. That's the rabble, as John Adams used to say. Dr. Erwin Redler, Associate Dean of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, Director of its National Center for Disaster Preparedness, said, this is an extraordinarily draconian measure. He put it rather bluntly, just laid it out. He said, the translation of this, martial law in the United States. Yeah, the Bushies have been wanting to declare martial law all along. Yeah, wouldn't it be a fine idea? Get rid of all those pesky things like civil liberties, civil rights. Yeah, we don't need that stuff. If the unprecedented federal militarization of New Orleans and the Gulf states did not provide ample enough grotesque proof that the Bush administration, this is from this online journal, intends to seize every opportunity to impose a police state under any pretext, real or imagined, the writing on the wall is now nightmarishly clear. Bush's war for oil operations are failing. The U.S. economy on the brink of tipping over. And here you have Bush. I mean, this is, it's so spooky. This is so similar to when the Reichstaggebäude, the parliament building in Germany, was burned by Marius van der Lubbe on, what was it, February 27th, 1932 or 33, as I recall. And van der Lubbe, this basically nutty, kind of semi-insane Dutch guy, comes in. After several tries at several other buildings, he was quite ineffective. Quite ineffective. And he comes in and he says, that's it. That's it. You know, and finally he was successful. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake
wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream. If we blindly stay the course, this
battery in New Orleans. New Orleans, Louisiana. Three police officers in New Orleans charged with battery Sunday after an incident in which two repeatedly struck a 64-year-old man accused of public intoxication. The three officers were suspended without pay, then released in order to appear in court at a later date, Captain Marlon DeFillo said. So, you know, the tragedy is it takes videotape to make this kind of thing happen. Right. I realize we're a little all over the map here today in terms of covering the news. It's sort of our best of the rest of the news day. But Howard Dean, but in fact, moving along from New Orleans, Howard Dean finally says to the Democratic Party, "Hey, you guys, wake up and do something. Wake up and, you know," the DNC National Committee Chairman Howard Dean delivered the party's game plan for unifying Democrats and winning back the White House on Sunday. "This is a national race. This is what happens to America," said the former Vermont governor and 2004 Democratic presidential hopeful. "The Republicans don't get to say what the playing field is anymore." Dean has undertaken the task of recasting the party's image, making it a values community and reform. I think this is absolutely great. Howard Dean is finally saying, hey, we're going to have a party of values. He says this is a national race. This is about what happens to America. The problem is the media is not listening to Howard Dean. It's like the not only have the Republicans captured so much of the media, and it's really not even so much like the Republicans sat around and says, okay, we're going to capture the media. It's more what has happened is that the media has been consolidated into the hands of a very small number of very large multinational corporations who really have as their primary interest making sure that, their interests are served, that in what you call the news, their interests are served, that nothing but their interests are served. And so you have the weird spectacle, for example, 2 years ago of MSNBC, at that time, a relatively new network formed by NBC, which is owned by General Electric, the big defense contractor, and Microsoft, a player in Washington, D.C., a significant player in Washington, D.C. In fact, one of the big lobbying firms in Washington, D.C. has the name Gates in it, no surprise. So MSNBC taking off the air the most profitable, most highly rated program that they had. Taking it off the air. Why? Because it was Phil Donahue. And he was speaking, he wasn't even speaking out against the war because the war had not yet happened, the war in Iraq. This was the lead up to the war in Iraq, but because he was raising questions. He was saying, do we really want to do this? Do we really want to go to war? And so here you have. You know, the network of Chris Matthews and Joe Scarborough, you know, that guy who just, you know, he's all, you know, let's keep Terry Schiavo alive forever, you know, who can. I have to say Keith Olbermann is on there. I have a lot of respect for Keith Olbermann. I even occasionally have some respect for Chris Matthews, but geez Louise, I mean, The networks, this is, of course, just a cable network, but right across the board, the networks are all now part of giant conglomerates, and their news operations are profit operations. And you have to recognize that it's not about the news. If it was about the news, we wouldn't have months and months and months going by trying to figure out what happened to some pretty white girl down in Aruba. It's about something much larger than that and much worse than that. Dean has undertaken the task of recasting the party's image, making it one of values, community, and reform. He says, we want our country back. We're all in this together. We're tired of a president who says it's okay to divide people to win the presidency. Oh, but dividing people makes such good infotainment. Dean identified several goals for the party that include balancing the budget, the renewable energy policy, and national health insurance. Howard Dean, here you have the chairman of the Democratic National Party coming out and saying, we need national health insurance. We actually, by the way, already have national health insurance. It's called Medicare. All we need to do is say, everybody in America is Medicare eligible tomorrow morning. That's all you have to do. Very simple. Well, obviously, you'd have to raise taxes to compensate for it. But the increase that you would pay in your taxes is less than the amount you're paying right now for your health insurance. Because by getting the blood-sucking leeches of the health insurance industry out of the health care milieu, so that they're no longer paying their officers and their CEOs millions of dollars a year, they're no longer having their fancy corporate head. You know, if some other company can do it. You know, the solar companies. Let the emerging companies that are going to be making solar panels and windmills and alternative energy that are going to replace the oil industry, let them take over those headquarters. Let them start hiring all those people in the healthcare industry who will suddenly find themselves unemployed because, you know, Medicare could easily run the program for 1 or 2 or at the most 3% overhead instead of the 20 and 30% overhead that we're paying to private health insurance companies. So here you have the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, a physician himself, I mean a guy who's really in a position to know about how health care works, coming out and saying, we need a national health care policy. We need a national health insurance program. Did you hear it covered on any network news program? Did you read about it in this morning's paper? Did the AP do a big story about it? Somehow I doubt it. And the guy's the head of the Democratic Party.
And people say, where are the Democrats?
They're out there.
Why am I not hearing about, you know, what the Democrats are proposing?
Because the media's not reporting them. I mean, it's just boils down to that and nothing more. We need jobs in this country, and we can't have it without universal health, says Howard Dean. It's so vital. I'm Tom Hartman. Get involved, my friends.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our project, our topic this... excuse me, I've got this incredible echo in my headphones. It's making me crazy. Will Bullock is with us. He's been working with the Food Project, a groundbreaking nonprofit urban agriculture and education organization. And hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
Great. Good to have you with us. And Will, are you going to be at Bioneers this weekend?
Yes, I am. I'll be speaking on Friday and Saturday.
That's great. This is our Bioneers segment. Bioneers.org is the website for more information on that. And, Will, tell us about the Food Project. Well, first of all, tell us about yourself. How'd you get in on this?
Well, I started when I was 15 years old. Honestly, I was just looking for a summer job. I wanted to do something with my summer.
And how long ago was that?
I was in 1995, so this summer has been 10 years since I've been doing this work with them.
Okay.
And I actually just, you know, it's something that I really learned that I loved. And food, it really had a strong impact on me throughout the rest of my life, and it changed who I was, so I stayed with it.
Mm-hmm. And so the Food Project, how did the Food Project start?
The Food Project was founded in 1991 by a man by the name of Ward Cheney. And it was basically a guy who just really wanted to find, he believed that food could be used to change people and society and its views. And he pretty much started it with the current executive director, Pat Gray, and the current program director, Greg Gale. It was three people who started it. And they had a vision, and they just made it happen as far as getting young people from the city and suburbs together. And they had a staff of three, and I think the first year they had maybe 12 youth, and they just made it happen. And from there, it's grown into an organization that's employed over 600 young people since 91. And we went from having you know, maybe a couple of acres of land in Lincoln, Massachusetts, which is the second wealthiest town in Massachusetts, and to having 31 acres of land there and also 2.5 acres of land in the city.
Yeah, and you're also in the Roxbury, North Dorchester area, which in my recollection is the working class neighborhood.
Yes, it is. We consider it lower income, and that's where I live. And the reason why it's very important that we have land there, because a very strong part of what we do in the food project is bridging gaps, bringing together people from both city and suburbs, bringing together the older people and younger people. We believe that diversity and a lot of different, you know, addressing diversity is a very big part of addressing the food systems movement and the problems in the food systems movement, I should say.
Well, Bullock, you said that food can be used to change people.
Yes.
Now, I'm assuming that you weren't talking about we'll make them healthy by giving them more food, although that's a nice side benefit. You know,
yeah.
they get healthier. But by change, you mean the political perspective? You mean understanding of the interrelatedness of us and the biosphere, those kinds of things, or political change? I mean, what kind of change are you looking for here?
Okay. All I can do is speak from a personal perspective. When I was 15 years old, I went into this job with one primary goal, and that was to get a paycheck. And to make some money. And 10 years later, I'm still there. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is because it had a personal impact on me. I think a big part of the problem right now in society is that people are disconnected from what we used to be connected to, which is the land, which is food. And so for me being reconnected with that, it changed me. It changed my perspective on society. It changed my perspective on the importance of food. I learned a lot about my personal limits, my personal how far I could go, how far I can push myself mentally, physically, and spiritually from working out on farms and on the land.
Yeah.
I've seen food itself bridge gaps.
For example.
Okay, so this one thing that we really do at the Food Project is we try to.
Will? Up? I think we just lost Will. I'm sorry. We were talking to Will Bullock of the Food Project there, and I believe in the other studio somebody picked up the phone and dumped Will, and so we've lost him. I'm sorry. You're going to have to get him back on the line because. We were talking with him there just a second ago. We'll get back to him. But this is really a cool thing. And by the way, if you want to know more about Bioneers, go to bioneers.org and check out that website, the Food Project. In the meantime, Pat Robertson, sometimes I just shudder saying the name. Pat Robertson, the guy is now saying, okay, the floods, the natural disasters that we're seeing around the world, it's not, and all the death and destruction, this is not the result of global warming, this is not the result of Bush administration incompetence. Pure and simple, this is the end times are with us. These are the guys who, you will recall, blamed 9/11 on us, on Americans. They said it was Americans who were responsible for 9/11, and just a wrong thing. So, Will, you're back with us.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Hey,
I am.
Sorry about that.
No, that's no problem.
So, the Food Project, you were talking about changing people through food. And,
yeah.
And that's at the personal level. But you guys are also distributing food through an internal distribution system. You got a couple of farmers markets. You've got shelters, soup kitchens.
Yes.
What are the consequences of this? I mean, are you competing? Do you have local farmers who are saying, hey, you guys are competing unfairly with us and things like that? I mean, is there any kind of blowback to what you're doing?
No, we're not. And actually, I think, unfortunately, I can say that's not happening because what we're doing, especially within the inner city, we are addressing a problem. We're addressing a problem that is not being addressed. So there are not many farmers markets there are not really any farmers markets in the Dorchester-Roxbury area that we work in. And there's a very large population of people who have agricultural backgrounds, who really, you know, from Cape Verde, who really love food and love, you know, healthy food, but they don't have access to it. So we're trying to create this access to this healthy food through our farmers markets and our commercial kitchen that we have in the city as well.
Right.
I would say, unfortunately, we are not having that problem. I would love to have that problem because that means that means a lot of people are trying to address this issue.
That would mean that you're getting big enough to be problematic for them.
Yes. Yeah.
So if somebody wants to start something like this in their local community, how do they do it?
Well, we have a program at the Food Project that actually focuses on replication. So all they would have to do actually is go on the Food Project website, www.thefoodproject.org, and look up replication. There's a lady by the name of Liz LeCluse who works on that. We have a lot of brochures, manuals that have been written. Talking about how we run our programs and so on and so forth over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's material out there, and we are actually set up. This was the first year that we actually replicated another site in Massachusetts. So in the North Shore, there's a food project running there as well.
Will Bullock, did you say it's foodproject.org? Or
yes, thefoodproject.org.
The Food Project.
Yes.
So you include pick.org.
Yes.
Okay, pardon me, I interrupted you. You were going on there.
No. This was the first year that we actually have replicated another food project site that's not immediately connected to the organization.
Now, part of the Food Project program is also addressing childhood obesity, public health and diet, reaching out to kids.
Well, yes, it is. We really try to raise awareness about health in general. But the main part of my job, the part of me that really focuses on that is I'm a Kellogg Food and Society Policy Fellow as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's
as in Kellogg Corporation?
Yeah, the Kellogg Foundation, yes.
Kellogg Foundation.
Yes.
Interesting. Now, was the Kellogg Foundation started by Mr. Kellogg, who was actually a health food advocate? He mm-hmm. he invented cornflakes as a cure for tuberculosis way back at the turn of the last century, the previous century. Is that foundation so separate from the company that they're willing to promote things that might not be in the best interest of big sugar producers, or are they, you know, what's the connection there?
From my understanding, it is separate. It is separate.
Mm-hmm.
From my understanding, what they did is they have a certain amount of money that they have that they pretty much have set aside to focus on these issues. So I don't know every small part of it, but I know that from my understanding, it is a separate organization because, as you said, it would be, in a way, it is sort of it's an interesting situation because whenever I say Kellogg Foundation, people say, oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, cornflakes? You know, so.
Yeah. Well, good old Mr. Kellogg, actually, you know, he had some pretty good ideas.
Yes. And
Kellogg's actually makes some pretty good products, although, they also have a lot of sugary stuff that people think are problematic, but, you know, it's a free market.
Yes, and I mean, I can honestly say that this, I mean, they have an annual conference every year, and that's, that really opened up a lot of opportunities for me to start to get the word out and speak about, you know, health issues and youth in the food system and how youth need to be involved in it. So they've given me a lot of opportunities to spread this message. And there's a whole entire movement that's happening right now of people from all over the world who are really trying to make change in the food system.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing syndicated, spinning liberal people beater.
Strung-out hypocrite prescription cheater. Rush looks strange to me.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM. And Victoria Jones is with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria. Up.
Oh, yes. Hello, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can now. I had to push the right button here. So, welcome to today. It's just been an absolutely nutty day, technically. Hopefully it hasn't been obvious to all of our listeners, but it's been a wild day so far. I think we've got things worked out. So, anyhow, what's happening in Washington, D.C., Victoria?
Well, I'm actually actually in New York City, but from what I'm hearing in Washington, D.C., the couple of things. One is that we're now finding out that it was a hoax about the security scare in New York last week.
But it did a great job of getting Karl Rove's going before the grand jury off the front page.
Well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? And I don't even know if that was the intent, but that was certainly the effect. So, however, he just is not able to hide from this because finally the press is recognizing that this is a real story, which they've ignored, and it is going to get coverage because they now smell the downfall of a powerful man, and they'll all get onto it and all act self-righteous like they always thought it was a big story when they laughed at me when I kept talking about it.
Yeah, you mean in the press conferences and the gaggles and things?
Right, in press conferences, they'd look at you like, oh, why'd you ask that again, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And now they all think it's big. And the fact is, it's huge.
Yeah. So what's we're hearing what was it? Bill Kristol was talking about there's going to be 22 indictments.
That apparently is what Bill Kristol is saying. Now, there is a theory that I've heard coming from the left that they're trawling the 22 indictments number so that if, in fact, it's only two or three, they can turn around and make it look good, kind of, you know, the under-expectations of George Bush in the debates, that may be what they're doing. Now, whether Bill Kristol actually does have access to anybody in this, I don't know. He has not been all over the stories in this thus far.
Mm-hmm.
But he might be quite a good conduit to get that out. Of course, they could have always leaked it to Bob Novak. We know he's always good for a story. Oh, sorry, that's the reason we're in this mess in the first place. Goodness me.
Goodness you.
Goodness me.
So, okay, so this thing is playing out. This whole situation with George W. Bush saying that he's going to veto the military appropriations bill, if it has attached to it a rider or a piece of legislation which simply says that the Army has to follow their own rules when it comes to the torture of detainees. Where's that at right
now?
Well,
I think it's going to become a huge problem for him. I don't think he realizes that even though the American people support our troops, they really don't support torture, and that they do see a correlation between us behaving badly to other people and other people deciding that it's even more okay than usual to behave badly to us. And I also don't think that he's taking into account that there are Republicans who are going to be running next year who are going to be in a difficult situation if their own president vetoes this bill. And he's also going against his own party, so he may do it.
Has this made it?
He's out of office. He doesn't care.
Has this thing made its way through the House yet?
I don't think it has.
Yeah, so it hasn't come up for a vote, but
no.
a similar rider has been attached to it in the House, has it not?
Yes, it has. Now, of course, the House is always a bit more tricky because it is more held by Republicans, and some of them are, you know, pretty wildly to the right. However, you know, they're up for election in 2006 also, and they know that this is an unpopular war. They know that the Republicans are unpopular. And how would if they get some Iraqi war vet Democrat running against a guy who'd signed off saying torture was okay? I just don't think that's going to play in a lot of close districts.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a lot depends on how they spin it. I mean, he's not in favor of the flag, and I am. You know, the Republicans are not going to use the word torture. They're going to do the same thing. I mean, keep in mind, when John Kerry voted against the $87 billion for Iraq, the reason he voted against it was because there was a provision in that bill that said that Halliburton could reincorporate its Kellogg Brown and Root division offshore and not pay any U.S. income taxes on the billions of dollars from that bill that were going to go to Halliburton. And he said, that's wrong. We have to have a law in here, a rider in here, that says that if they're going to take our taxpayer money, they have to pay federal taxes. And that was what it was all about. And yet somehow that message never got out to the American people.
No, it didn't get out to the American people.
So I think they're going to re-spin this in the same way. They'll just strip the word torture out of it, and they'll say, well, this guy voted against supporting our troops, against military appropriation.
I think they'll try, and I think it'll work in some places, but I even think that and turning Max Cleland into a traitor and things like that, I don't think that's going to play as well as it did 4 years ago, simply because people are finally, slowly, and it's not people's fault, it's you know, that we don't get the story out, you do, people are finally waking up to the fact that this is spin, and if Karl Rove does start to go down, the amount of news stories there will be on the lives that he's destroyed and on his machinations behind behind the scenes are going to make it even more likely that ploys like this won't come through. We'll find out that he was behind the John Kerry thing.
Yeah.
We'll find out that he was behind the John McCain thing.
From your lips to God's ears. We'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thanks very much.
Good talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
First we'll frisk you, then we'll test you, and it won't be so bad if you should fail.
Uh-oh.
Tell my friends hi if they arrest you, 'cause they've also spent time in jail. You will arrest you.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. I want to talk about economics here for a few minutes. And there's a bigger picture here with regard to this whole economic thing. There's a much bigger picture here. And that bigger picture is that the conservatives in the United States and in Iraq, they're trying to do the same thing. There's an agenda that's going on in Iraq, and there's an agenda that's going on in the United States, and we are seeing the same thing played out in both places, and most people are completely unaware of it. And what it is they're promoting this idea that labor should have no rights, that the only thing that matters is the maximization of profit, of corporate profits, pure and simple. And they really and truly believe in this utopian notion, this idealistic idea that was in large part brought about, you know, it's the old feudalism, but the new incarnation, the more recent version of it, is really the Ayn Rand notion. Ayn Rand in her book Atlas Shrugged. You know, who is John Galt? Where you've got this noble capitalist who wants to build a railroad, and he wants to do all this good stuff, and then you've got all these evil bureaucrats who stop him from doing it. Now, keep in mind, Ayn Rand, her father, she grew up in Bolshevik Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution when she was 10 years old. Her father lost his pharmacy, he lost his small business to the Bolsheviks, wiped him out. She then, you know, so she saw the downside of the nationalization of all business, and she saw that it didn't work particularly well. And then as a teenager in her early 20s, she went to the University of Kiev and studied economics. And what they tried to teach her was all about communist economics. And she got it that it didn't work. And somewhere along the line, she got this bizarre idea that capitalism was a political system. And it's not. It's an economic system. She came to the United States. She started writing these novels basically saying capitalism should be the political system. And that's what's going on both in Iraq and in the United States, is they're promoting this idea that our economic system should be our political system. And the end result of that is that the people who have the greatest economic power end up ruling politically. And that's not what the founders had in mind. What the founders had in mind was that we, the people, would rule politically. We would make decisions. And of course we want to promote economic activity. Of course we think it's a marvelous idea if somebody wants to start a business. We're all in favor of that. Oh, of course. And as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out so eloquently, when big business becomes too big and it becomes too, and it begins to harm the public interest, then it's the obligation of we, the people, to step in and say, oh, wait a minute, you're breaking the rules here. So here are the stories that tie this stuff together, that frame this big picture of how really what the agenda, what the real conservative agenda is about, is all about money, and it's all about power, and it's all about money and power of and through the economy. And the first thing they have to do is strip the middle class, strip the working people in this country down to the working poor, so that they're politically impotent, so that they don't have the money to launch campaigns, so they can't fight back, so they can't speak out, they can't hire a lawyer. break them down. So in Iraq, for example, which was going to be the great laboratory, you remember Wolfowitz had this idea, let's go into Iraq and let's create a libertarian paradise, a flat tax of 15%. Paul Bremer imposed it. The cons here, they all love the idea of a flat tax. Wouldn't a flat tax be wonderful, they say? Well, you know, in theory it sounds nice. But the reality is that we are all at least double taxed. In other words, you make your living, you get and you pay an income tax on that tax, and now you've got some money and you go out and you spend that money and you pay tax again. You pay a sales tax. Or if you're paying your property taxes, if you're living someplace, you're paying property taxes. You pay your utility bill, there are taxes attached to it. You pay your phone bill, there's taxes attached to it. So we're all double taxed. But if you make enough money that all of your income isn't going to covering your living expenses, then maybe you're only single taxed. You pay an income tax, and then you put that money into, say, tax-free municipal bonds. And you make money off the money, and you pay no taxes whatsoever. So in a flat tax world, the people who get screwed are the people who are spending 100% of their income just to live, which is about 95% of Americans. And the people who do very well in a flat tax world are the people who are not spending all of their income just to live. And for them, a flat tax is effectively a very, very substantial tax decrease. You know, forget progressivity. So, number one, flat taxes are harmful to working people, and they're the most harmful to the working poor. Because now the working poor are paying the same income tax rate as the billionaires. And every time they spend a dollar, they have to pay a sales tax on it. Every time they pay their housing expenses, they have to pay the property tax piece of it. Every time they pay their light bill, they're paying a tax on that. So they're being taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed. So a flat tax is a way of screwing more taxes out of, extracting more taxes from average working people and particularly the working poor. And you just have to understand that. That's the fundamental premise of a flat tax, is tax relief for billionaires and whack it to the working poor and the middle class. Now, the interesting thing, there's a weird, interesting little irony here, and that is that the cons who are all gung-ho about flat taxes are opposed to flat taxes when it comes to the Social Security tax. The Social Security tax, right now, is only paid on the first $90,000 of income. So if you make $1 million in a year, you pay no Social Security tax at all on $910,000 of that $1 million. None. Not one penny. And one of the very simple proposals to cure the problem of the Social Security tax, of FICA, is simply make it a flat tax. Oh, no, we can't have that, say the cons. We've got to keep it capped at $80,000 or $90,000, so only the working people of America pay into it. Are you starting to see an agenda and hypocrisy? Okay, now take this back to Iraq. Iraq was where they wanted to try this thing out. This is where they were going to first start this thing. They said those liberals, after World War II, they rebuilt Europe and they did it in such a way that they could show that they were, you know, Harry Truman tried to get through national health insurance in the United States, and when the Republicans took the House and Senate in the election of 46, Harry Truman in 47 lost the ability to do that. He tried in 1947, he proposed a national health insurance program, Medicare for all, didn't go anywhere because the Republicans shot it down. So when they were rebuilding Europe, Harry Truman said, let's prove to the people in America that universal health care is a good thing. Let's prove to the people in America that it's a good thing for the economy, it's a good thing for the people, it's a good thing. And so Germany and Japan have universal health care. He was trying to strengthen labor unions. The Republicans were trying to weaken them. In 1947, the Republicans passed Taft-Hartley to weaken the labor unions, to create union-free zones, and particularly in the southern states, so states could opt out of parts of the Wagner Act provisions. Harry Truman and the guys who were putting together Europe, putting back together Japan and Germany after World War II, they said, let's prove to America that with strong labor, strong unions. You can have a strong economy and you can build a strong middle class. And guess which two countries after World War II grew faster and better and bigger than any other countries in the world? Germany and Japan. So anyhow, Wolfowitz and Pearl and Feith and Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, they all look at this and they go, you know, those liberals, they tried to prove that their principles work with Germany and Japan. It was a fluke. That's the only explanation they have for why it works so well. It was a fluke. So we're going to show how our way of doing things will actually work. So in Iraq, we're going to do away with labor unions. We're going to make a flat tax of 15%, 15% income tax. We're going to, you know, right across it, we're going to allow corporations to do anything they damn well please. A company can repatriate, expatriate all their money. They can make profit in Iraq and take all that money out of the country. They can bring in all the cheap foreign labor they want. We'll turn it into an Ayn Rand libertarian paradise. And now the workers in Iraq... Did I say Iran? If I did, I meant Iraq. The workers in Iraq are saying, enough already. On April 9, 2003, U.S. tanks pulled up to Basra's huge dilapidated oil refinery. We were coming out early at the end of our shift, and there was the American Army, recalls Faraj Arbat, one of the plant's firemen. He was ordered to lay face down on the ground. He did as he was ordered, Arbat said. He says an American put a foot in his back. Well, anyhow, to get to the punchline here, they're starting a union. They're trying to organize. And the problem is, it's against the law. Nonetheless, Arbat says, at first there were only 100 of us, but workers began coming out. Some took their shirts off and told the troops, shoot us. Others laid down on the ground. 10 even went under the tanks, brandishing cigarette lighters. They announced that if the soldiers fired, they would set the tankers alight. This is not a threat of terrorism. They don't intend to kill innocent people, but they were willing to give their lives in defense of their jobs and their national resource. The oil workers unionizing in Basra, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the
sand. And welcome back, my friends.
Open up our eyes.
Yeah, it's time to open up our eyes. The unions are forming in Iraq. They're starting to say enough already. And at the same time, now you've got American corporations doing business in Iraq, and they're in there running around, you know, with our tax dollars. And much of this money is actually Iraqi money. We're talking $8-10 billion a year is Iraqi money coming into Iraq. That, you know, the oil revenue that is supposed to be used to rebuild Iraq, and that money is being given to corporations like Halliburton's, Kellogg, Brown & Root, and others. And what are these companies doing with it? They're importing low-wage laborers from Asia into Iraq. Into Iraq! This is from Democracy Now! Meanwhile, in Iraq, Corp Watch is reporting that tens of thousands of low-wage Asian laborers are traveling to Iraq to work for U.S. military contractors such as Halliburton. These at salaries of $200 a month. People from the Philippines, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal. You get this? I mean, this is incredible. Or is it? Or is it just, you know, this is the way they're doing it. You can find this at the corpwatch.org, the article. Jing Solomon left his family in the Philippines for what sounded like a sure thing, a job as a warehouse worker at Camp Anaconda in Iraq. His new employer, Prime Projects International, PPI of Dubai, is a major but low-profile subcontractor to Halliburton's multi-billion-dollar deal with the Pentagon to provide support services to U.S. forces. But Solomon wouldn't be making anything near the salaries starting at $80,000 and topping $100,000 the caliber that Halliburton's KBR pays to truck drivers, construction workers, office workers, and other laborers it recruits in the U.S. Instead, the 35-year-old father of two planned on making $615 a month, including overtime. $3 an hour. That's what he was expecting to make, $3 an hour. He traveled from the Philippines to Iraq to work for Halliburton for $3 an hour. And when he got there, they only paid him $1.56 an hour. This is an article by David Finney on the CorpWatch site. He was going to spend most. He was going to send most of his money home, but not so much money. He says, I wanted to save the money up, buy a house, provide for my family. That simple dream drives hordes of low-wage workers like Solomon to travel to Iraq from more than three dozen countries. They're called TCNs, third country nationals. Once in Iraq, TCNs earn monthly salaries of between $200 and $1,000 a month. Cooks, accountants, beauticians, laundry workers, warehousemen, carpenters, construction workers. Tens of thousands of them. Why? Well, it's a little more expensive to hire Iraqis. And you wonder why the Iraqis are a little upset. Why are the Iraqis a little concerned with us? Why are the Iraqis saying, hey, what's going on? When, you know, these American companies, they're bringing in all this, you know, there's something wrong here. And they're starting to blow back. They're saying, I mean, just imagine for a moment that Vicente Fox, the former Coca-Cola company executive who's now the president of Mexico, the Vicente Fox got up on his high horse one day and said, you know, at George W. Bush, he wasn't really elected in 2000. His brother handed Florida to him by stealing the vote from over 100,000 African Americans. And we're going to save America from itself. George W. Bush has become a menace, a danger to democracy, and says Vicente Fox, and we're going to save America. And so they invade the United States. And then they change our Constitution so that Mexican corporations can come into the United States and just simply take over big sectors of our economy. And instead of hiring Americans, they fire all the Americans, so we have an over 50% unemployment rate in this country. And they start importing people from El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua. And those people are now working in the United States for 50 cents an hour or a dollar an hour. And all the rest of us have to stand around because we're unemployed because these Mexican companies won't hire. How long do you think we would stand for that? And yet the average American sees this going on. They're watching Fox News. They're going, oh, that's cool. Hey, look at that. Yeah, Halliburton's making another profit. Halliburton's stock was around $20 when we invaded Iraq. It's around $60 now. Those 433,000 shares of Halliburton stock, stock options that Dick Cheney's sitting on, doing pretty good. Not to mention the $100,000, $150,000 a year salary he's getting from Halliburton. He's making as much from Halliburton as he makes as vice president of the United States, not to mention the millions he's making from his stock increasing, and the people in Iraq know it. They know it. And people in America sit around going, gee, I wonder why they're upset with us. I wonder why they don't like us. I wonder why they're, why are they doing roadside bombs? Why are they shooting at us? We don't understand. Why an insurgency? What if Mexico invaded the United States and said, no more labor unions? It's banned. That's the end of it. Do you think we'd stand for it? We're going to bring in all the workers from South America to put all the Americans out of business. This is, it's incredible. And Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and Bush and Cheney actually thought that this would produce a paradise in Iraq. You can see how demented these folks are. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our new telephone line, 1-866-440-THOM, doesn't seem to be working. And try to call it ourselves even and can't get through. So if you want to try and reach the program today, just for today, we're going to fall back to our old phone number, 1-866-889-8894. And that will get you in right here into Portland, Oregon, and we can mix your phone calls here on this end of the board. So if you want to, you know, weigh in on the issues of the day, 1-866-889-8894. I want to continue with this economic thing for a little bit. A new study from Hewitt Associates just came out, showed that U.S. companies are paying 10% more for health benefits in 2006 over 2005. This is crippling big companies like General Motors. GM reported Tuesday it lost $1.1 billion in the first quarter, its largest quarterly loss in more than a decade. Why? They said because of health care costs. We have a system, a health care payment system in the United States that depends upon for-profit corporations paying the health insurance cost of their workers. That, you know, if you're going to have health insurance, you've got to have a job. Now, again, this works to the benefit of the cons who have this notion, this bizarre idea that the whole purpose of an economy, that the whole purpose of a government and the whole purpose of society is to serve the economy. It's really the other way around. As Abe Lincoln said on December 3rd, 1861, his first annual message to Congress, labor is prior to and independent of capital. In other words, people started working with their hands before somebody paid them to or somebody owned the businesses that they were doing it. He says, capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Abe Lincoln's first address to Congress. But, oh no, say the cons, can't have it that way. Can't have it working that way. So we have a system, a healthcare system, where the only way you can get healthcare is to have a job. And because your healthcare is paid for through your employer. And what that does is it gives the employers one more hand around your neck. Which is just fine with the conservatives because, as I've said, they're not interested in democracy and they don't want there to be a healthy middle class. After all, we saw what happened in Germany and Japan when that happened. The countries got prosperous and peaceful. And happy, and they didn't build huge militaries, and they didn't have an explosion of uber wealth. Is the conservative agenda starting to make sense now? You can see why they would be opposed to health care for everybody in America, even if it costs less money. We could fully provide all of the health, dental, eyeglasses, everything, all of the health needs of everybody in America for less money than we're spending right now. If we simply took Medicare and made it available to everybody, a single-payer health care system, very simple. You could do it tomorrow morning. And all of us would be spending less money. And we'd have the same quality, a better quality of health care in the United States. But your employers wouldn't have their hand around your throat any longer because anybody could have health care. Well, we can't have that. Amazing. Well, let's just get into the phones here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Billy in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Billy, what you doing?
Hey, Tom. So, you know, they're giving us a choice, not us, the workers a choice. You want full pay, or do you want us to pay your pensions? That's a choice. Yeah, go ahead and laugh. Because
well, I mean, that's the point. It's the same thing. It's why they're trying to take apart Medicare or take apart Social Security. The more that they can throw this stuff into the hands of employers, the stronger the grip of employers around the throats of the American working people.
Yeah, exactly. This is going to be known this last year or so, in the next few years, will be known as the great union busting years. That's what Harriet's all about. This pro-business kind of thing.
You mean Harriet Myers?
Yeah. I mean, there's two things. There's two reasons she's there.
Well, that's what John Roberts was all about, too. The guy's a corporate lawyer who's making $1 million a year defending the biggest corporations in America.
And she's there to handle the criminal end of the thing so that, you know, when all the criminals come up to the Supreme Court, I mean, that's the question they should ask her, shouldn't they? Will you recuse yourself when your criminal friends show up here, when the Scooter Libbys and the Karl Roves, because if you think Karl Roves is going to go to jail, he's not. He's going to
get pardoned
all the way to the Supreme Court. Right?
Yeah.
So this was the choice that we're now giving our unions. Destroy all the old workers by destroying their pensions and keep your money. In other words, they're actually making the union destroy itself from within.
Yep. And this is, and by the way, Billy, this isn't the last year and a half. Ronald Reagan began this process.
Well,
and arguably the Republicans began it in 1947 when they passed the veto of Harry Truman when they passed the Taft-Hartley Act.
And you're right about Ronald Reagan, because the biggest thing he did was by taking away the penalty, and by that I mean taxes, on the highest earners, it became so attractive to steal from your own employees. And isn't that always what these people are doing? Every airline executive who's ever lived has been a thief at the cost of his workers. Everyone.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'd be quite that universal, but I think your point is really well taken, and I appreciate your calling and making it. And Billy, you make it so eloquently. And thanks also for listening to us there on KRXA in Santa Cruz. And this is it really, you know, there's a book out by I don't have the book here, and it's been a while since I had the guy on. I don't remember his name, but I thought it's an interesting point that this guy makes. He asked the question, why is it that there are so few people who make $5, $10, $15 million a year salaries? He said, if you've got to pay a lot for something, it must be really rare. And his suggestion was that it's hard to find people who can both destroy their employees and sleep at night. That there's not that many sociopaths out there. So when you find one, you've got to pay them really, really well. Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara.
Hello, Tom.
How you doing?
You made the comment about the foreign workers being pulled into Iraq. The foreign workers are the ones that have gotten the jobs in New Orleans and the Gulf States.
Yeah, the same thing's happening here with the same companies, by the way.
Absolutely. And that's why the poor Americans who need the work so badly to try and get their families back together can't get a job still.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is and it is so naked now. And what is so amazing is that the media is not reporting on it. And why? Because the media and Halliburton are essentially all the same thing. It's all the conservatives declared class war in the United States when Reagan came into office. And they have been waging that war ever since. And they started using the phrase class warfare to describe anybody who spoke up in favor of working people so that to insulate themselves. See, it's the old trick that Hitler perfected of accuse others of what you're doing.
Slave labor, indentured servitude, no housing, no guarantees of health care, no rights, everything that our union people died for.
Yeah, yeah. And are continuing to all over the world, and that our workers now are dying for in the United States, increasingly in increasingly hostile, increasingly dangerous workplace environments. Barbara, thank you for calling and for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Keith in Kent, Washington. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It is indeed a banana republic, paraphrasing Henry Waxman. My question is, you know, they've proven through their actions that they have corrupted the system. And most people I know are no longer willing to work within the system. The system is broken. They've cheated us out of our country. And we need a revolution of the mind. And that requires everybody to make the assumption that they don't operate in our best interest, then they are not the recognized government of this country, period.
Keith, when you say you're not going to work within the system, what are you talking about?
I guess what I'm saying is that I would like to see hundreds of thousands of people gather at state capitals on a given day and protest through our state legislatures that this federal system has been corrupted.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen. People are too busy working trying to just barely make their mortgage payments. I mean, that's the thing. See, the reason why the conservatives wanted to create an essentially bankrupt middle class, a class of working poor, was because they'll be politically impotent. They will not have the ability to do what you're suggesting. And that's why I say instead of giving up on the system, we need to take over the system. And that's why people like you and me should be showing up for the county Republican or Democratic or Green Party meetings and participating.
I was a caucus member, and when Howard Dean was disemboweled because of his statements that were carried by the media, are you with me, Tom?
I am.
I believe that was part of the plan, that John Kerry was just as culpable as a corporate front man, and had he been elected, he would have been unworthy. You know, he took John Edwards instead of someone like Robert Kennedy Jr. so he could say they're raping our environment the way they're raping our country. You know, that he didn't stand for anything, and he was put out there to keep someone like Howard Dean from getting the podium.
Because I don't see it in those terms, Keith. I understand what you're saying, and I know that there are a lot of people who think that. I suspect that John Kerry actually would have made a fairly good president. I think John Edwards would make a very good president for the United States, and I have a feeling he's going to be back. In fact, if there was an Al Gore John Edwards ticket or something like that, I think it would have an enormous amount of power. But I didn't see John Kerry just as another stuffed suit, although I was just terribly, horribly disappointed when he didn't fight for Ohio. I mean, they still haven't counted 90,000 ballots in that state.
Bottom line was in the first debate when he said, "Mr. President, four words describe you, more of the same." Those four words should have been, "You are a liar."
Yeah, well, except... Well, yeah, okay. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that John Kerry should have come out swinging, and he should have fought a lot harder. Keith, thanks for the call. I appreciate your point. But see, we can't refight the 2004 election. We've got a plan for the 2006 election and the 2008 election. And those elections are not going to go the way that we want them to go. They're not going to work out, you know, in a positive way unless we do something, unless we take it back. Very quickly, Tom in Seattle, we have about a minute. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to say I've listened to some right-wing talk shows lately, and now the big thing that they're putting out is that the Bush administration's PAC policies are starting to pay down the debt. But the fact of the matter is how they're doing it is separating more money from the American people through the gas, raising the gas prices. Every time they raise the gas prices, they also raise the taxes, because it's all
in most, I'm not sure about the federal gas tax, but I know most state gas taxes are fixed. They're not percentage. Here in Oregon, it's a fixed amount. It's not a percentage amount. And I believe that that's the same around the country, that most states have their state gas taxes fixed as a certain number of pennies per gallon.
But not the federal. The federal is a percentage to the price per gallon.
Sure, yeah. And
so they're raising our prices. Every time the gas prices go up, they raise our taxes. And nobody's saying that Bush is raising our taxes in a huge way since he came into office. He's been raising our taxes.
Yeah, there you go.
And nobody's saying it.
No, you just said it, Tom, and I'll agree with you. Thank you very much for that. I do appreciate it. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. It's the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I'd look, your eyes would find.
Good old Bob. Bob Dylan. No, nobody like him. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, here in the midst of all this, we've been hearing that, Bush's tax cuts are finally working. You know, it's finally making a difference. You know, isn't it a wonderful thing? You know, finally he's got his tax cuts are producing a positive response. Sort of. You know, maybe. Well, by and large, he says. And you'll recall his original premise was that if we gave millionaires and billionaires a half a million dollars, they would create one job. And so if you give a millionaire, well, it was actually $550,000. If you give a millionaire $1,100,000, they'll create two jobs. If you give a millionaire, $10 million, they'll create 20 jobs. You know, basically, that was the original premise, the original rationale behind the tax breaks. Remember this?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
Now, you have 1 million jobs divided into $550 billion. That's $550,000 per job. Now, the American media was doing such a great job that everybody in America figured that out. That's what Bush wanted to do. Make the rich very, very rich, and maybe we'll create jobs. Are these going to be jobs that pay $550,000 a year? Somehow I doubt it. So you've got Bush out here saying, you know, this is what we're going to do, And now they're claiming, well, you're seeing the economy is getting better and better. And why? Because of our tax cuts. Turns out, not so true. The only thing that has held the economy together for the last 4 years is that starting in 2000, 2001, Alan Greenspan took us into actual negative interest rates. At least on the Fed fund rates, the bank-to-bank loan overnight loan rate, the interest rates that were charged was below the rate of inflation. If you simply borrowed money and sat on it, by the time you had to pay it back, it was worth more than when you first borrowed it, because inflation ate it up faster than the interest it cost you. And what that did was it made it possible for people to, it lowered the payments on people's houses who had mortgages. If you were going to buy a house, the payments went down. As the payments went down, the price went up because demand went up. Got easier to buy a house. Housing prices started going up. As housing prices were going up, people looked at their house and say, "Hey, I bought this house for $100,000. Now it's worth $150,000. I think I'll borrow $50,000 on it and I'll spend that money." And that's what Americans have been doing. They've been taking all their money out of their houses and spending it. And now Alan Greenspan is going, "Oops. We've got to raise interest rates because we've got inflation now, or at least the risk of it coming down the road, particularly with the oil prices and everything. And if we start raising interest rates, guess what's going to happen? The value of houses is going to start to fall. People are going to start walking away from these mortgages." Big editorial op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae sitting on billions, tens of billions of dollars of these mortgages. And mortgage companies doing interest-only loans and adjustable-rate mortgages, they're really starting to get nervous that this is the bubble that's going to blow this thing all apart. And it had nothing to do with tax cuts. The tax cuts was just a giveaway to the rich. We'll be back with your calls, 866-889-8894, in just a minute.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs.
And welcome back, my friends.
Here
34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. And we're really in the midst of one of our piggies alerts, really, if you get right down to it.
It's 291 billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed?
Yeah, like Alan Greenspan.
Find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play on.
Oh, but they always, always, always have clean shirts, these bigger piggies. Well, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan turning up the volume of his warnings about the potential perils of certain risky mortgages. We're finding 10 years ago, nobody was getting interest-only mortgages. Nobody would even think of giving an interest-only mortgage. It's suicide. What you want people to generate equity in their home over time. Well, the home prices have been rising so much that they're selling these things saying, hey, take an interest-only mortgage, and the value of your house is going to go up. You're going to get equity simply because the value is going up. Now, what happens if the value starts going down? You buy a house for $100,000, and all of a sudden it's worth $90,000, and you still owe $100 on it? And you're only paying interest payments? And on top of that, what if it's an adjustable rate mortgage? What if the interest payments go up as the prime rate goes up? So your payments go from $300 a month to $350 a month to $400 a month, and you're paying $400 a month in interest only on a house that's not even worth that. It's not even worth what you paid for it anymore. What most people do, what happened the last time this cycle came around in the 70s, what happened back in the 20s, as the Great Depression happened in the late 20s, early 30s, people just walk away from their homes and walk away from their mortgage. Well, they tried to change the bankruptcy laws to make it more difficult, but still, I mean, people are going to do that. And so now Greenspan is saying, hey, in the event of widespread cooling in house prices, these borrowers and the institutions that service them could be exposed to significant losses, says Mr. Greenspan. That is Greenspan speak for, holy cow, get out of the way. There's a disaster coming. It's a train wreck heading down the highway. Seriously. I mean, you know, when Greenspan starts talking about significant losses, I mean, those are words that the Fed chief, I mean, that's, whew. And we find now that 17%, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, 17% of all mortgages, all loans in the second half of 2004, interest only. $1.225 trillion. And almost half of that was refinances. People refinancing what do they do? They're taking the money out of their house and they're spending it. And that's the only thing that's keeping the economy afloat. And number one, I got to say, it's an incredibly dangerous thing to do. And number two, It's not going to guarantee any kind of safety for this economy. It's a potential disaster. Rebecca in Edmonton, Washington on the line. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Why did I just get this thought in my head that says, what fools these mortals be? Is that from Shakespeare?
It is from Shakespeare, yes.
Okay. Well, there's so much on my mind. I hope I can get it out. But I know that you've written about corporatism, corporate personhood.
Yeah. What
is the title of your book?
The main book that I wrote is specifically and exclusively about corporate personhood is called Unequal Protection.
Okay. Well, we need to read that in our Democracy for America group. We have over 100 people who have who have joined our Democracy for America group in North Seattle. I live in Edmonton.
That's great.
Which is on the north side.
Mm-hmm.
At our last meeting.
I was there yesterday.
I just hated that I couldn't be there. But anyway, at our last meeting, what we did was we did a program called Connecting the Dots, and we put up all the names of all the people, you know, people like Elliot Abrams and everybody that we feel has anything to do with the Bush administration, past, present, or future. Excuse me just a minute. Pardon me. So anyway, it was 2 hours, very interesting give and take and discussion, and out of that, what we decided is that for the next meeting, we really need to talk about corporate personhood. And I recently saw a video which is entitled, Can Corporations Be Persons? And it was a lecture. And some women in Minnesota have an organization, and it might be nationwide, but anyway, what I got out of it was this. They have a saying, slavery is a legal fiction that says that persons can be property. And corporate personhood is a legal fiction that says that corporations can be persons.
Yeah, and
when we abolished slavery, here's my question, do you think it is possible that we can ever abolish corporate personhood if we could get a majority of people on the Supreme Court who aren't corporatists, is there any possibility? I know with
yes.
Myers and Roberts, I can't see it happening, but
no.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think so, Rebecca, and thank you for calling and raising that issue. Yes, absolutely. And in fact, if you look at every, and the reason why I say yes is because that's the way it was in the United States for almost 100 years after the founding of this country, that corporations were not persons, that a corporation could not last more than 40 or 50 years. It was against the law for corporations to own stock in other corporations. It was against the law for corporations to give money to politicians. It was against the law for a corporation to do more than one thing. Corporate monopolies were outlawed. And so, I mean, that, in fact, this country was founded in a revolt against a multinational corporate behemoth, the Walmart of the day, the British East India Company. It was called the Boston Tea Party. And the Tea Act of 1773 that provoked the Boston Tea Party was a tax cut, a corporate tax cut. Now, for some strange reason, most people think it was a tax increase because the cry of the colonists was no taxation without representation. But it was a tax cut. Look it up. Go to the Encyclopedia Britannica and type in Tea Act 1773. It was a tax cut specifically for the East India Company to help them put out of business small entrepreneurial tea importers in North America. And the colonists said, hey, you're going to try and Walmartize our country? We're not going to stand for it. So it's happened before here. We had a long tradition of it, and it lasted right up through about the 1870s. And so, number one, I think it can happen again. Number two, I don't think it's probably going to happen via the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't lead public opinion. The Supreme Court follows public opinion. The reason Roe v. Wade happened was because a majority of Americans were very concerned that women did not have equal rights in the United States and that they didn't have control over their own bodies, but mostly that they didn't have access to the Constitution, to the Fourth Amendment and others, and the 14th Amendment. In 1873, Sarah Bradwell versus the state of Illinois, in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that women were essentially only derived their rights through their husbands and fathers. And in 1973, in Roe v. Wade, they reversed Bradwell versus state for all practical purposes. That's mostly what it was about. It was about, do women have access to constitutional rights or not? And, of course, that's why conservatives want to roll it back. They would just assume women were not even voting. It was the progressives who were pushing for the vote for women, progressive men who were pushing for the vote for women from the 1880s through the 1920s when it happened, because they felt that women would move politics in a more progressive direction. They were right. So, in any case, the Supreme Court doesn't lead, it follows. And so it's a matter of generating enough public debate and enough public opinion, and that's what that group is doing. And the group that you were quoting, by the way, is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF. And it was probably either Jan or Molly, it was probably one of these folks, one of the folks with WILPF. And they're absolutely a marvelous group. It's the oldest women's rights group in the United States. Two of their past presidents have been Nobel Prize winners. It was founded by Jane Addams, and they've declared a 3-year campaign to abolish corporate personhood. And they use my book, Unequal Protection. And so, you know, I recommend you check it out. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Charlie in Arcata, California. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Are you sure it's not Cheryl?
Oh, I'm sorry, Cheryl. Yeah, I need to get my glasses stronger here.
Good enough. Hey, nice talking to you again, Tom.
Good. What's up? Thank you for calling, Cheryl. What's up?
Well, you know, it is time that we take back America from this fascist government, and fascism is also alive and well here in California.
But it's not. Hang on. Let me. We have to be careful of the language we use. We don't have a fascist government. We have a fascist administration.
That's true. Okay, I won't be so broad.
Yeah, because the system of government that we have is actually pretty good. It could use a little fine-tuning here and there, but it's fairly good. But we've got people running it who are running it into the ground and trying to destroy it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not very happy with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and you know, I tried to oppose him from the beginning. I mean, we should have learned our lesson not having a actor in government the first time when we got Ronald here. But at any rate, we're trying to oppose all these horrible initiatives, and we have a constitutional initiative, which is 77, which John McCain joined Arnold on, and this could be coming to a state near you, where they're looking at redistricting the state by judges.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is kind of scary. I mean, the bottom line is they just want to turn our nice blue state into a red state.
Sure. Sure, like they did Texas and like they tried to do with Colorado.
Absolutely, and it's just outrageous. And, you know, all I can say is people who are angry out there have to get active, join up with the Democratic Party, Democracy for America, MoveOn.org, and get out and fight. I mean, I think this is like a...
And don't forget the Republican Party, Cheryl.
Yeah, any moderate
let me say,
people.
You know, yeah, join the Republican Party, too, because if good, rational people were to take back the Republican Party, you know, it's a political party. It's got a great tradition. It's been around for over 100 years, and marvelous things could be done with... Yeah, I mean, Dwight Eisenhower was actually a pretty decent president. Where are the Dwight Eisenhower Republicans?
They're not in this administration, that's
no,
for sure.
No, they're sure not.
And when I, one thing I wanted to say is when you call these neocons, I have a little bit stronger language. I call them neocon artists.
Yeah, that's a good name.
And I also have a name for George W. Bush. He's the son of a Bush. And
no.
We need,
okay.
And I'd like to see the man impeached. That's all I can say.
Okay, well said, Cheryl. I appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Impeach the son of a Bush, yes. Well, you know, what can you say? I'm not disagreeing. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If you're out of a job and your pension's been robbed, well, it's no act of God. You've been bushwhacked.
No, you sure were.
You were 40 plus, but you're still going bust because your rent's going up. You've been bushwhacked. You've been bushwhacked, Jack.
And it's time for us to unbushwhack the country.
Perhaps it's time to whack.
Banking regulators are monitoring the flurry of risky mortgages and plan to issue regulatory guidance to banks. This is from the Associated Press. Janine Aversa, the AP economics writer. Average home prices soared 13.43% during the 12 months ending in June. Biggest gain in more than a quarter century. This, my friends, will not last. And a whole lot of people are going to get caught short. And it is not going to be pleasant. Do not, please, I say this unequivocally, do not get an interest-only mortgage or an adjustable-rate mortgage now because inflation is coming. And in some markets, well, not everywhere, but in a lot of markets, we're going to see housing values going down and cash is going to become king. I mean, it's we can talk economics or investments some other time. Scott in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
I'd like to, perhaps on a different key, express my deep sense of personal dismay for the police brutality that occurred over this last weekend in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yes, this 64-year-old retired elementary school teacher who was not intoxicated.
Right. And I can't quite help but recall how on the Today Show back a few weeks ago, there was a walking interview with a community leader down there in which he expressed the hope that those who were gone from Louisiana, that some of them would stay gone. I almost serve... think that there is somewhat of an effort to selectively reformulate the population of New Orleans.
Oh, there is, and it's an economic effort, but it wasn't those cops who were doing it. Half of those cops were black. It was not as the guy who was beat up today. He did an interview today, you know, and he said this wasn't about race. He said the guys beating me up were the same color I am.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's not the issue. But Scott, you raise an important one, and I appreciate your calling in and raising it. I got to tell you, back 10 years ago or so, I wrote a series of four novels, private detective novels. Just, you know, it was just fun. I was doing it. They never got published, but it was great fun writing them. And I wanted to learn about the world of police, and a good friend of mine was a private detective, a guy by the name of DeWitt Wanamaker in Georgia. And it was the year of the Olympics in Atlanta. And DeWitt said, hey, you know, the Georgia Police Academy, for the first time in its 138-year history, was opening itself up to allow civilians, private detectives, to go through the state police training course. and so that they could become security guards for the Olympics because there weren't going to be enough cops. And he said, do you want to do it? Do you want to go through the police academy? And I said, sure. And so I took a few weeks and moved down to Valdosta and went through this kind of short course with the police academy. And I remember in the toward the end of the third week there, I'm sitting there with DeWitt. And I got DeWitt got me in, and as a private detective, I got the badge and the license and the whole bit, went through the whole thing, you know, because I was, as I said, I was writing books about this. And I remember sitting in the Georgia Police Academy, they've got this huge atrium where they can actually march 50 guys back and forth, you know, in formation for when it's raining and things. And there's a dining area there, and we're sitting there in the dining area in the Georgia Police Academy and watching these guys drill back and forth. And I said to DeWitt, and DeWitt had been an old police chief. DeWitt was in his 60s at the time. He was an old small-town sheriff before he went became a PI. And I said, DeWitt, what do these guys make? And he says, oh, I think they start out around 25, something like that, $27,000 a year. And I said, you couldn't pay me $27,000 a year to have people shoot at me. And he chuckled, and he said, you know, half those guys out there, you give them a gun and a stick and let them do anything they damn well please, they would pay you. And you know, I really got it. There are a lot of very, very good police officers in the United States, and a lot of people who, for whom it is a noble and important calling. And there are a few basically schoolyard bullies. And it's one of the big challenges the police departments have, is how do you sort out the schoolyard bullies, the guys who just want to beat people up? In fact, you know, when we were doing at the police academy, we were studying hand-to-hand combat, and we had an Aikido instructor from the Secret Service, and I got into it. With one of the guys who, one of the other people who was going through the course with me, and this guy, his name was Stanley. He was a cop in a small town near Valdosta, and flipped me down hard and started yelling at me, and it just went off ballistic. This guy, and because I had flipped him the wrong way, and hurt him. I mean, not injured him, but hurt him. And you just get it that there are, you know, this is one of the big challenges. And so, frankly, I think that that's what. I think what happened in New Orleans happens in police departments all over the United States. It's rare that it gets videotaped. It's a tragedy. And when we start paying our cops and our teachers as much as we're paying our corporate executives, then we will have a society that's a whole lot safer, a whole lot more comfortable, and a whole lot, you know, and growing much more rapidly. But as long as we're paying our police officers poorly and thus willing to take what we get, as long as we're dissing our teachers, we're a nation at risk. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for calling in. Thanks to the folks running the board there at Air America. Thanks for David and Louise. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.